This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the National Museum. My name is Mike Pickering. I'm the head of the museum's research centre. I'd first like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, which the museum is built, and to pay respects to the elders both past and present. Welcome to the next in our History of the World in 100 Object lecture series. So far, we have explored big history, dawn and diaspora, and today we keep moving through time to the cradles of civilization. We have Dr. Stephen Burke and Dr. Lewis Siddle, who will give us an insight into the early cities and civilizations of the first millenniums. Dr. Stephen Burke from the University of Sydney is an archaeologist with 35 years field experience in the Middle East. He is director of the Pella excavations in Jordan, where the debris of human occupation stretches back many centuries. He has worked in Syria, Turkey, Cyprus, and Egypt, and is a research associate at the Near Eastern Archaeology Foundation at Sydney University. Dr. Lewis Siddle is from the University of London and Macquarie University, and is a history master at Shaw in North Sydney and an honorary associate of the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University. He is director of the Cuneiform in Australia and the Cuneiform in Australia and New Zealand Collections Project, and is writing a book on the life and career of the Assyrian king Sennacherib. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Stephen Burke to the stage to begin the discussion? Thank you.
Technology is wonderful.
And you want your little buttony thing?
I think this might be my buttony thing, but let's find out. Yep, buttony thing. My brief today is very much a matter of the third millennium BC. And in a way, it's looking from Ireland to Pakistan. So I'm going to leave a few things out. I'll touch on a few things specific to the exhibition and try and give you some context about what you might be looking. When people think of cradle of civilizations, they invariably think of ancient Mesopotamia, the Sumerians, and Ur. Cities grew up by rivers. Rivers brought silt. Silt supercharged agriculture, meant you had a reliable surplus, as long as it rained. And with that surplus, you could spend money on something other than feeding yourselves. And the earliest civilizations of the 4th and the 3rd millennium BC did just that. So that you tend to find in the southern Mesopotamian regions, the great cities of Sumeria are characterized by palaces with wall paintings, massive temples of mud brick, which we sometimes are lucky enough to find in shrines. And when we can find out, multi-story houses with 6 to 8 rooms, which are not uncommonly filled with materials that come from across the Middle East and beyond. In other words, stone vessels from Iran are found throughout the Middle East and the southern Levant. Copper can be sourced to everywhere from Oman to Hungary and places in between. And of course, there's a wide range of drinking and storage vessels. It's a prosperous society built on the back of successful agriculture. It's also a society that becomes increasingly prone to war as the third millennium stretches on. You have a Middle Eastern version of the warring states as China in later times, so that effectively you have a series of competing cities competing for what? Agricultural land and resources and access to those resources, resources that come from outside Mesopotamia. A simple map of resource acquisition in southern Mesopotamia, the Sumerian heartlands, will source obsidian from Anatolia, lapis lazuli from the Afghan northern border, carnelian from Pakistan and fine alabaster from the eastern desert of Egypt. And you can find that in pretty much any one of the major cities in the Fertile Crescent. Acquisition of exotic stone, acquisition of jewellery items, is a way that people communicate with each other. Effectively, in a society that is, broadly speaking, without writing, a society that, broadly speaking, is without iconic communication devices, the first way that you communicate with someone is what you wear. Who you are is what you wear. And this is helpful because you don't really want to bump into a warrior or a king by mistake if you're a peasant, because it tends to go badly. Equally, if you are two aristocrats bumping into each other in the street, it's as well that you know your place in the pecking order, or that too can become a source of problem. And we're a long way from the peelers and the police force in the third millennium BC, given that we have the law codes, which probably date back to this time, and those law codes make it pretty clear that percussive discussion went on quite a lot between equals, such that an eye for an eye was not just a biblical concept. Bling is typical of the third millennium BC. This is a moderate tomb in a moderate area of central Syria, Tel Benat. And you will find obsidian, carnelian, gold, silver, lapis lazuli in multi-stringed necklaces. Partly, it's very nice stuff we buy today. Partly, it's a measure of your power. Lapis lazuli is not found down the road. It takes a lot of money to get it there. It's a way of signalling who you are, who you aspire to be, and who you expect to be treated, how you expect to be treated. And so this stuff is communication. It's communication in hard stone and beautiful golden earrings, or in many cases nose rings and lip rings, but it always looks more elegant if they're hair pieces. And so we come to the first object, the harp from the royal graves at Ur, this one from the famous grave of Queen Pu'abi. Ur isn't the largest of the Sumerian cities in southern Mesopotamia. It's about the third or fourth ranked. But the reason that Ur is useful is that there was a series of royal graves discovered by Leonard Woolley in the early 1920s and dug in 26, 27, 28. It's about 16, and when we say royal, we kind of mean royal, princely, mums, dads, cousins, uncles, but with a lot of money. One of the things from the get-go that surprised people is just how many skeletons are found in these tombs. And these aren't skeletons of aged retainers that have been put gently to sleep themselves. These are young, virile warriors, and in many cases, songstresses. These are people in their 20s. Doesn't show in the plans, but they often find them with tiny, small cups beside them. Pretty clearly, they took a draft. And the concept of quietly walking in to a large pit, reasonably characterised as a death pit, and then quietly sitting down, taking a draft, and following your mistress, she's up here in the chamber, full of the most exotic bling, wonderful jewelled headpieces, which contains lapis lazuli, carnelian, gold, silver, obsidian. So she's effectively going into the afterlife declaring who she is. Now, there's quite a lot of discussion about the vegetal motifs and the queen's role in fertility, but I'm not going to bore you with that. The critical thing for me with this harp, it's a small harp, it's a knee harp. And in two cases, Woolley was able to show that the young lady, and she is a young lady in her 20s, has actually got her hands around the strings when she died. So we have to have a concept here. It's not just a piece of art. It's a beautiful piece of art. It's got lapis lazuli and gold and whatnot. But it's being used by someone in their 20s, perhaps as a double row of her friends, quietly sang as they dropped off to sleep as she played the harp. it gives you an idea that for all of the bling and all of the jewellery that you might manage to imagine yourself wearing, this past is a foreign country. These people have very different views of life and death and afterlife. And it's, to me, a fairly sobering thought. Reconstructions, again, there are many harps. There's a lot of musical instruments played in parties, offerings to the gods, healing ceremonies. People knew that music healed mental illness, even in the 3rd millennium BC. But the concept of 30 people in three rows, elaborately gowned, carrying their musical instruments, sidled into a 4-metre deep, 12-metre wide pit, and sat down and took a draught, and followed their lady, or in this case, possibly their lord, into the afterlife. Again, just emphasises the fact that this isn't quite what it appears to be. This isn't just a musical instrument that you might imagine some Irish bard playing. Imagining someone playing that as it all becomes quiet. At the same time, in Northern Europe, places like Stonehenge, the first simple form of Stonehenge, Newgrange in Ireland, and the great stone lines of Carnac in France are part of the, broadly speaking, great megalithic culture of the 3rd millennium and the 4th millennium BC. It's not, as we used to think, ex oriente lux. Everything good comes from the East first, not a bit of it. There are independent and extremely impressive civilizations in Europe at exactly the same time as the royal graves that were in use. And these civilizations have very nice stone, bone, flint, copper, silver, and quite a lot of gold. This is a warrior from Varna in southeastern Bulgaria, dating as early as about 4,200 BC. So don't imagine that all the elaborate golden jewellery must have gone to Europe from the Middle East. Quite the contrary. They were very skilled metalsmiths themselves, and you will see evidence for it in the golden torques in the exhibition. The torque, again, sort of a neck piece, a very public neck piece, displaying again the wealth, the status, the communication of who the wearer is. Probably a king, but certainly a member of the aristocracy. For although there are some magnificent bronze works like the Danish Sun Chariot, typical assemblages of copper, and even just possibly astronomical phenomena. Again, 3rd millennium, pushing into the 2nd millennium BC, but European metallurgy learns nothing from the Middle East. It's highly sophisticated, and we can source the metals to show that they come from European sources. The interface between Europe and the Middle East, Crete, is a wonderful amalgam of the two. We all know a little bit about the great Minoan civilization that lay off the coast of Greece and created the magnificent palaces at Knossos, Phaistos, and of course the world-famous wall paintings. They were, however, extremely skilled metalsmiths. You find a modest, small example of Minoan metalsmith's work in the exhibition, but you should see it in the context of the detailed inlaid swords that come from contemporary deposits in the shaft graves at Mycenae, which are inlaid with silver, yellow and gold, and even allowing for the potentially Kaiser Wilhelm II moustache in the royal graves. It should remind you that this Minoan style, if not actual Minoan metallurgy, loses nothing by comparison with Middle East. trying to understand how all this works and how the interconnections might work, if indeed they exist, and they probably did, because we can source amber from the Baltic into the Middle East. We can source beads from Pakistan in Greece at the same time. Possibly it has something to do with the Central Asian steppes, chariots, heavy wagons, really. They're not exactly Ben-Hur here, but they probably are more like the wagon trains that move backward and forward, connecting China and Northern Europe and the Middle East via the Caucasus, and certainly Central Asia and Iran. We see various forms of wheeled vehicle from the 3rd millennium BC. They are a common part of the European Bronze Age of the 2nd. They are common in Central Asia from the 3rd. They get more mobile, better understanding of spokes, better understanding of weight bearing and axle protection. And they show up in China in the 2nd millennium. So the likelihood is that this is at least one of the ways that people communicate. Of course, in the old days, everything came from Mesopotamia, but we're now pretty sure that the understanding of horse and the use of horse originates in southern Russia in the 5th millennium. We're now beginning to understand that the horse cultures spread both into the Middle East, into Asia, and into Europe at that time. Beads. You always feel sorry for the bead studiers in archaeology. They spend most of their time hunched over. They're like medieval jewel smiths. They can't really focus much beyond their fingers. But they do, from time to time, turn up some awfully interesting things. One of the major exports of the Harappan civilization, and I'll come to them in a second, in Pakistan, are these so-called etched carnelian beads. And what they actually do is they literally etch out and fill in with inlay carnelian beads. And you might think, how lovely. Well, yes, we found them all the way up and down the Gulf. We found them in Central Asia. We found them in the Caucasus. And we found them as far away as the island of Aegina off Athens in Greece, all 3rd millennium BC. So made in Pakistan and showing up at least as far as Greece. But then when you think about the fact that some of the copper and tin as well in Greece at this time comes from Cornwall, you have a link between Pakistan and Ireland fairly effortlessly, which should teach us to be just a little bit careful when we talk about the ancient world's narrowed horizons and our much greater interconnections today. Because a case could be made for linking the great cradles of civilization one with the other from at least the 3rd millennium BC, 5,000 years ago. Harappan civilization is one of the last great mystery civilizations that archaeologists are grappling with. When it was discovered in the 1920s, or fully understood in the 1920s, it seemed a bolt from the blue, but the gift of the Indus, if you will. Nowadays, well, until things got a little interesting in Pakistan, people were able to show that, as it were, hilly slopes of Pakistan did engender this culture in the 4th millennium BC. But this is a culture that has major 50-hectare sites with huge compounds, wonderful august stone sculpture, and, as I say, lots of these beads. The Harappan civilization is exactly contemporary with the great cities of Sumeria. And one of its great glories are these stamp seals. What are they? I wish we knew. The Harappan language is still very difficult to interpret. More recent times, people have suggested that it might be a form of Proto-Dravidian, but that's the last guess. At least it's not Martian anymore. But we have so few inscriptions, and they're so short, and they may be very specific to the purpose of the seal, that it's hard for us to know precisely what language we're dealing with. We need longer inscriptions and we don't have them. That said, these stamp seals appear up and down the Persian Gulf, up onto the Euphrates River. And they are most definitely Indus Valley in origin. And they can be pretty cool. They can be wonderful seals of elephant, bull, but they can also be of people or deities. We can't read, so we don't know. But they are found throughout the Harappan civilization of the Indus Valley and adjacent lands, right the way up the valley, the waterways across Iran into Central Asia, onto the borders of Syria. So this is the 3rd millennium BC in Pakistan, linked through to the great civilizations of Egypt and Mesopotamia effortlessly. And one of the main things that they're exporting through their colonies at Shotagai on the Afghan-Tajik border is lapis lazuli, which shows up as far away as Libya in the 3rd millennium. Carnelian beads and jewellery of the aristocrats of the Indus civilization achieve the same aims as elsewhere: to differentiate people, to communicate who you are, to communicate how you wish to be treated. We'd be a lot clearer in our concept of stratified society if we read inscriptions. We can't. We're still trying to work on that. But we would guess, not unreasonably, that they are trying to communicate similar messages. And one of the reasons is because of these little beads, these little ridged, rounded beads. We have them in Indus Valley necklaces, and we have them as far away as Troy, Central Asia in Maikop. In effect, we have material from the Indus stretching across this entire area, material from Mesopotamia stretching from the Nile into Central Asia, lapis lazuli from here stretching right the way through to Greece and Egypt, and some of the gold and copper and tin links the cultures of Northwest Europe and the Scandinavian cities into the Mycenaean Minoan world and through them into Egypt and the Middle East. So in effect, what these objects tell us a little bit about is the interconnection of the ancient world. And it's a modern cheek, it's a modern hubris that we are the great interconnected society, that people's lives in the past were nasty, brutish and short, that they knew very little outside their own villages. Study of the archaeological evidence with a solid chronology makes it quite clear it was possible for someone in Ireland to have reasonable knowledge of things happening in Afghanistan, because objects moved, and if objects move, ideas can move as well. So when you get to the end of the exhibition and you look at the Wi-Fi and you realise that 20 to 30 years ago, we keep being told, we were a far less connected society, and that as speeds increase and as frequency of communication, as I know from my email from my students, increase, we tend to assume that something phenomenally new has happened. But really, of course, it took a long way, a long time, for Ireland to be connected with Pakistan. You had to schlep stuff from one place to another. And it's more likely that you move stuff by degrees from place to place. But really, from something like the 3rd millennium BC, the time of the first great cities, up until the modern world of today, what we're really talking about is an increase in speed of communication, increase in the frequency, increase in the ability for large units of things to be moved, which in the past was problematic, the limit to how much you can put on a donkey before you flatten it, which is why those wheeled wagons were helpful. And if you think in terms of civilization and interconnection between civilizations as a matter of speed and frequency of communication, One of the measures of civilization might be effectively increasing bit speed. And nothing new is happening here. It's merely a slow progression of technology from a time in which communication was slow to a time today in which communication is faster. But we always like to do these graphs that show the ski slope up to the modern world today. I'm not so much convinced that in 5,000 years' time they'll consider this to be a slow ascent to something in the future that we can't really even easily conceive of today. Because it's all about bandwidth, it's all about speed, and in our own lifetimes we've seen quantum leaps in both. But I suspect they saw that as well, as far back as 5,000 years ago in the 3rd millennium BC. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen, for a very entertaining lecture. Certainly something that has been coming out through the exhibition is the interconnectedness of all those cultures. And one of the messages that we try to sell here to make the exhibition relevant to Australians is how our own culture is so much built upon the interplay of so many cultures over space and time. We're not as far removed from them as we like to think. I now move on to invite Dr. Lewis Siddle to the stage to continue our exciting journey.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you. I'm talking about something a little bit more narrow, though I hope just as interesting, and indeed is in its own way a technology. It's looking at the development of writing and indeed its origins. In his work, The Histories, the 5th century historian Herodotus took the time to account for the introduction of writing to Greece. For Herodotus, this was a great accomplishment and it came from the East, Phoenicia to be exact. But the Phoenicians did not invent writing, and their script comprising only consonants that the Greeks used to develop their alphabet derived from far older writing systems, namely Mesopotamian cuneiform and Egyptian hieroglyph. Indeed, in the early books of the histories, Herodotus often marvelled at and provided translations of Persian and Egyptian inscriptions he saw during his travels. Now, it'd be asinine to pass comment that Herodotus valued the practice of writing. However, his descriptions of texts he encountered often note their key characteristics, and he gave a sense, and this gives a sense of their grandeur and cultural importance. For instance, in Book 4, Herodotus states that then, after arriving, after seeing what he, and that is Darius, could of the Bosphorus, he had two marble columns erected, on one of which was an inscription in Assyrian characters, showing the various nations which were serving on the campaign. The other had a similar inscription in Greek. What I like about this description is the sense that the scripts carry in themselves meaning. In the Behistun inscription you can see here on the slide, Darius commissioned the same text to be written in three different languages, Elamite, Babylonian, and Old Persian. These were the languages of the entire Persian Empire, and therefore this was a text for all peoples. And similarly in Herodotus' account, Darius had produced an inscription somewhere along the Bosphorus where Asia and Europe meet, and it was written in an Eastern and a Western script. But writing is not all about artistic pictographs and cultural indicators. Writing is also a practical technology, and it would be farcical to discuss the key features and development of the cradle of civilization without looking at it. Many of us use this form of technology every hour without even thinking about the impact it has on our social development. And much in the way that Stephen spoke about, consider, for instance, the way that text messaging on personal mobile phones has, for better or worse, shaped our social interaction. And if you think of writing as a technology, few innovations have been as influential. The ability to convey information through time and space is a major enabling factor in the organisation of a society. It means that humans have been able to establish ideas, traditions, and knowledge not only for their contemporaries, but for the many succeeding generations. In this way, writing is not merely the material existence of spoken words, but a transformative mechanism in the development of human civilization. What I would like to do in this talk is to look at artefacts used in the history of the world in 100 objects, both in the BBC series in the case of one object, but the others are all in the exhibition here at the NMA. And these objects illustrate the importance writing played in the ancient Middle East, in particular Mesopotamia and Egypt. And I'd like to explore some of the ways that they've been used, that writing has been used variously in these cultures. I'd like to begin with some thoughts about how writing originated. Writing seems to have been invented in four different regions of the world at different times: in southern Mesopotamia and Egypt in the late 4th millennium BC, in China during the 2nd millennium, and in Central America probably sometime in the 1st millennium BC. However, since the evidence in each case is so sparse, there is a great deal of debate about when, where, and why writing was invented and how it developed in these different regions. The evidence currently available suggests that writing was invented first in southern Mesopotamia. However, Egypt is another possible candidate. Much depends on what historians decide to use and how accurately archaeologists have been able to date the context from which these texts have been excavated. But let's begin with the clay tablet from Uruk, which you can see in the exhibition. This tablet dates sometime between 3400 BC and 3200. And that places it at the very beginning of writing in Mesopotamia. This tablet would fit comfortably in the palm of your hand, and the writing you can see on it is called cuneiform because of the wedge shape of the signs. Writing was formed by scribes impressing a reed stylus while the surface was still wet, making a triangular shaped wedge in the clay, and hence the name for the script comes from Latin cuneus forma, or wedge-shaped. Cuneiform was used to write many languages, such as Sumerian, as in the case of this tablet, but also Akkadian, Hittite, Elamite, Luwian, and others. Much like the way the Latin script is used today to write languages such as English, German, and French. Now, this cuneiform tablet records the distribution of beer to individuals and is probably either a record of a payment for a labour gang or it's a ration list. If you look at the bottom right corner, and I'm just talking about down here, what you can see is this is like, a header. And you have what would have been a drawing of a head here and a mouth drinking beer out of a bowl. And they often have these signs at the bottom in the corner like this, and I presume it's for some form of filing system or easy reference to see which tablet you're after. And what this tablet and the many thousands like it that date from this region and this era provide us is the best insight into why writing was invented, unfortunately, for accounting. To put this in some sort of context, the people who lived in southern Mesopotamia in the late 4th millennium experienced a great increase in urbanisation and, as Stephen showed us, certainly trade. This required a far greater system to administer the movements of goods, labour, taxation and revenue. The increasing pressure on city and temple administrators led to a technological development that saw a movement away from the existing system of tokens that represented the goods exchange to a system where abstract representations of commodities were inscribed in sign form on tablets, or to put it simply, writing. Now, I struggle to read text from this particular era because at this stage, writing was largely an aide memoir with a complete lack of any sort of narrative. In short, they are like reading shopper dockets, all figures and numbers with a few nouns. In terms of writing, most signs are logographic at this stage. They represent a particular thing or an idea. Often, but not always, the signs were pictures of the objects they represented. And in this tablet, you can see, well, I'll point it out to you, this sign turns up here, and here, and here, and here, and I'm sure in one or two other places, but you get the picture down here again. And this is a sign, cash for beer. Hence, we can see that it's being distributed out. And it, if you turn your head, the script is actually at 90 degrees. If you turn your head that way to the left, you'll see that it's actually a jug of beer. The scribes of this period, however, quickly realised that writing did not need to be restricted to logography. And by the third millennium, far more complex inscriptions were being produced. However, to do so, the scribes of the third millennium in Egypt and Mesopotamia developed their scripts in a way that separated the graphic mark or sign from its pictographic meaning and allowed a sign to represent a sound alone. That intellectual shift was a crucial step towards producing a writing system that could closely represent spoken language and produce sophisticated texts like hymns, epics, myths, and royal inscriptions. Scholars call this level of abstraction in a writing system the Rebus Principle. Once the Rebus Principle had been realised, scripts expanded, usually to cover all the needs of the scribes. Interestingly for us moderns, who predominantly use alphabets, each society invented a writing system that was based on syllables. And here you can see some examples of, you know, a hand which comes to have the sound D, a horned viper which gives the sound, represents the sound F. And while you may at this point say, ah, but isn't this an alphabet, what Egyptians don't do is write out vowels. So really what we're reading is a consonant plus a vowel syllable that was to be read and understood as you read it out. One can see this new practice in writing in some of the very earliest Egyptian texts. This ivory label was once attached to a pair of sandals, so we think, and it dates from the reign of the first dynasty pharaoh, whose name was Den, and he ruled sometime during the first centuries of the third millennium BC. It's an excellent example, not only of the Rebus Principle, but probably also why so many students go to Egyptology rather than Mesopotamian studies. Here you can see, already at this very early stage, how identifiable the characters are of Egyptian hieroglyph as opposed to the clay cuneiform tablet, which is largely to the untrained eye indistinguishable from a dog biscuit. But this small ivory label was discovered in Abydos in Egypt's south and features the pharaoh Den in an unmistakable pose as a brutal warrior, standing over his foe whom he's holding by the hair, with his other arm raised about to smite him with a raised mace. But the label it bears inscriptions that describe the scene and give some indications of its origin. All the inscriptions are at least partly written phonetically, putting the Rebus Principle into practice. So here you can see the name Den with a D and an N. Underneath, this is his Horus name. Down here you've got Semi, sometimes written Semit. And that's another one of his names. Pharaohs by the New Kingdom had five names, but in this period they largely have two. Over here we've actually got a little detail of what's happening, and it says something along the lines of the first occasion when the pharaoh had smitten the east. That's a word that must have changed over time, smitten. And over here is a bit peculiar. It says Inkar. And the best we can do with this section is we think it's the name of the official who had dedicated these sandals to his overlord. Hence we have the protagonist with both these royal names, a clear statement that Den was either the first to conquer the East or perhaps celebrating his first conquest of the East. He did sort of live up to this reputation in which he's depicting himself. He went on more than one campaign. And that the sandals were probably presented by a person named Inkar. In this way, Den's label represents a great departure from the early cuneiform tablet in many respects. Writing here is used to reinforce the royal state authority. rather than a function of local administration. Writing systems represent the Egyptian language closer than the archaic logographic system too, as we saw in the last tablet. But in time, cuneiform too implemented the rebus principle, as we can see here, and this is my favourite artefact in the exhibition. This is the flood tablet, named so because it contains a section of the standard Babylonian version of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which recounts the great flood sent by the gods to wipe out humanity. Sound familiar? This tablet is not a standalone composition, but is actually the 11th, or a part of the 11th tablet in the Epic of Gilgamesh. The tablet was first translated in the 1870s by a young Assyriologist working as an assistant at the British Museum named George Smith. The tablet had been excavated in Nineveh, which is in northern Iraq, in the famous library of Ashurbanipal, who ruled Assyria from 669 to about 627 BC. Upon reading the tablet, George Smith was struck by the similarities it bore to Genesis 6-9, or the Noah story. For those of you who are unfamiliar with this text, here are the highlights. It opens with Utnapishti, who's the Babylonian Noah, and his name means "I discovered life." And he explains to Gilgamesh how he survived a deluge. First, the lord of the gods in the Babylonian pantheon, Enlil, had been disturbed by mankind and decided to wipe them out with a flood. Now, we know from another text called Atrahasis that what caused the disturbance was the fact that the humans just made too much noise. So the original neighbour's complaint, I suppose, about a Saturday night party. And his answer was he was going to wipe them out with a flood, and I think we all know how that feels. But the god of wisdom, Ea, did not like this. And he had taken pity on the pious Utnapishtim and instructed him to build a great boat and to keep his family, all living beings and all the beasts of the field inside during the flood. The flood lasted 7 days, and there are different traditions about this, but in this text it lasts 7 days, and after which Utnapishtim sent out a dove, a swallow and then a raven to see whether or not the waters had receded giving indication that there was land on which to settle. So after recession of the waters, Enlil realises that he'd probably done the wrong thing and bestows immortality upon Utnapishtim. Gilgamesh, of course, is desperately seeking immortality. This is why he ends up searching out Utnapishtim. The decipherment of the flood tablet was George Smith's eureka moment. And much like Archimedes, who ran through the streets of Syracuse naked after inventing the water screw, Smith, upon realising the similarities with Genesis, proceeded to strip naked and dash around the room in the British Museum in excitement. It's not usually your first image of Victorian England, is it? The Epic of Gilgamesh is commonly held to be the greatest literary work from Mesopotamia and a forerunner to Homer's poems and the 1001 Nights. I would suggest that the legacy this epic has for world literature was far less likely to have happened had it not been for writing. Finally, I want to discuss the use of writing in the funerary stele of Didymos. Like Den's label, this stele was probably found at Abydos in Egypt, but it is dated to the other end of Egyptian history, to the Ptolemaic era, when the Greeks ruled Egypt. While the Ptolemies followed their predecessors and commissioned monumental inscriptions in Egyptian hieroglyph, in every other aspect of life they were candidly foreign, and most of the elite of this era spoke Greek rather than local Egyptian. In fact, it was Cleopatra who stood out in a way of trying to take the throne, learnt Egyptian to get the locals on her side. But this attitude of imposing Greek came to have, maybe not imposing, that's too strong a word, but at least speaking Greek among elite circles came to have an impact on many aspects of Egyptian life, not least writing. For the elite in society, the practice of the day was to commission funerary stele that displayed a fusion of Greek and Egyptian culture. The Didymos stele is a classic example of this type of text. The stele is divided in two sections. There's an upper section here, which is you'll recognise is very Egyptian. And you have the deceased, this is Didymos here, being led by Anubis, This is Anubis here. And before, yes, that's Osiris, which is what it says there, and Isis, whose name is there. So that's the top half. In the bottom half, you'll see, well, that's not hieroglyph. That there is Greek. And beneath that is a very, I mean, I can't read Demotic at all. I find it very difficult. But even those who do read Demotic find this inscription not particularly easy to read, but we suspect it's probably the same thing as what's written there. The Greek reads Didymos, son of Hierakon, 27 years old before his time. So he has died too young at the age of 27. Conversely, the Egyptian up here says, may he live forever. This juxtaposition of Egyptian and Greek scripts is reminiscent of the famous Rosetta Stone and indicates that in Ptolemaic Egypt, script was an important cultural signifier as any form of art. In a way, with the Didymos stele, we've come full circle back to Herodotus's description of Herodotus's description of Darius's inscription at the Bosphorus. The use of script in these texts is there to engage with different cultures. Now, I could go on and on about writing all day, but mercifully for you, I shall not. Instead, I'll finish with a statement about the joy of being an ancient scribe. And it is taken from the Middle Egyptian literary text called the Satire of the Trades. And the scribe who is instructing his son says, a scribe at whatever post in town, he will not suffer in it. As he feels another's needs, he will not lack rewards. I don't see a calling like it, of which this saying could be said. I'll make you love scribedom more than you love your mother. I'll make its beauty stand before you. It is the greatest of all callings. There is none like it in the land. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I'd now like to invite both speakers up to the comfy chairs and if there's time for some questions, if we have. You going to do the running? I don't know.
Yeah, now you've got to make these things work.
Thank you, I've really enjoyed both those talks. I have a question for Stephen Burke. The just in the on the net and in the papers about the possibility that Greeks worked on the Entombed Warriors has come out recently, and I personally thought, surely not. But your thoughts on that?
Well, I'd like to see a little evidence. Is it possible that at the time that first millennium BC, first millennium AD, or that area, that the Greeks knew of China? Yes, they did. We know they did. They wrote about it. They were quite clear. They knew about the great Chinese civilization. They had a pretty fair idea about India right the way down to the Ganges. There was a Greco-Bactrian kingdom that was flourishing as late as 80 BC in the Ganges Valley. There were certainly Greek colonies pushing deep into Western China, or at least Indo-Greek, let's call them, local Hellenized peoples, but again, as I said, it's a question of ideas and people moving backward and forward. And the royal roads stretched from Central Asia right the way through to Macedonia. And those roads were frequently used from probably the time of Darius, so let's call it late 6th. They only became more frequently used as you push through the Hellenistic age to the 1st century BC. Could there have been Greeks? Yes, of course they could. Did they need to be Greeks? No. The Chinese were perfectly capable of building the excellent civilization that is evidenced in the Entombed Warriors. What's fascinating is that they're beginning to have a good close look at the ethnicity of some of the warriors themselves. Some of those warriors don't look Han Chinese. they look like they might have come from quite a way west. But then, of course, we have to remember that what we consider to be the Chinese homeland today was much smaller even in the 1st and 2nd centuries BC. So that what made up the kingdoms of ancient China was a much more polyglot empire than today. So perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised. Is it possible? Yes. Is it likely? Less convinced.
Thank you very much for those delightful presentations. Really a pleasure to listen to. Just sticking at the macro level, particularly with Dr. Burke's speculation about connectivity, I wonder if we could just get opinion from both of you about the possible links between the two parts of the presentation. And that is, with the idea of connectivity going back all the millennia, how important might writing have been for bringing the parties together over these vast distances? And if it wasn't writing, what would have actually brought people together? And possibly bringing this connectivity out, would that connectivity itself have led to the importance of writing, or would writing have led to the importance of connectivity? So it's a rather complex question.
I think the precursors to writing could be informative here. I mentioned very briefly that there are tokens. The earliest thing, and some people will actually argue that this is writing. So as I said, you know, it depends what you class writing as. But in terms of where writing may fit in to what Stephen was talking about, is that you have these tokens that are clearly used as receipts for exchange of goods, usually cattle or food stuffs like barley, and you get this progress that you have these loose tokens. Then you start finding them in a bulla, a clay ball with the tokens inside, with the tokens impressed on the outside. And so it's accounting almost, you know, a little fraud check. Well, no, we've got this agreement, and there were 5 sheep that you gave me. And they say, well, no, I said I gave you 10. And then, okay, well, let's open up the clay ball to check how many are in there. And you can imagine as more cultures become involved with each other from further reaches of the world, all of a sudden, perhaps the move to something a little bit more complex, something more sophisticated, like writing, where you move beyond the tokens. And in the very early proto-cuneiform inscriptions, you do see these signs that were used in the tokens then coming into the writing system. So I think it would be through those sorts of interactions that would actually have pushed writing to develop as a technology. Does that answer your question in some way?
And I think I just add, it's useful. It helps you remember stuff. Mm. Once you get the idea of how this might work, you pick it up pretty quickly. It's fascinating to see that when the New World is conquered, the French trappers in Canada take about 5 years before the local Indians have worked out what's going on, and they're trapping the things for them. They're meeting the boats that are coming in to the shore before they get there. They're doing the accounting using French weights and measures. They pick it up 4 years after first contact. Doesn't take long for people to work out how to turn a buck. Writing is a really useful way of keeping track of your own guilt. People pick it up very quickly.
Yes, on one of the tablets you showed there earlier, on the cuneiform tablet on the flood, the left-hand corner was cut away. What's the significance of that?
Clay. We are so happy that the ancient Mesopotamians wrote on clay, because every time you burn down one of their cities, you accidentally fire their literature forever. But it's not 100% foolproof, and a lot of these, if the tablet's been picked up, it's actually been smashed. Now,
it looked as if it was pre-done for some reason.
Yeah, it would have been done. That was actually done in antiquity, and it now sits among many more fragments that actually join up. And what you see there is one column, and you see actually column three and a bit of column two. And it was actually originally, if you count both sides, a six-column tablet. It was much longer than what you see there too. So we've actually really only got a quarter of the original tablet.
I looked at the ghost form around the outside, mm-hmm. and it seemed to be very good formation, but the left hand was neatly cut off.
Yeah. It was found in 612, somewhere between 612 and 609, the city of Nineveh is destroyed. The Assyrians weren't the kindest of emperors, and the links that the Neo-Babylonians and the Medes went to destroy the Assyrian palaces, it wouldn't surprise me. In fact, there is a series of treaties that were signed between the Medes and Ashurbanipal's father, Esarhaddon, that were deliberately taken to the court of Nineveh. We found them in hundreds of fragments because they were there and smashed in the royal court. That's what we think happened anyway. But you've got this deliberate destruction of these artifacts that are going on. So if they ran through and raided the library and took them and smashed them to pieces in antiquity, that would be why, unfortunately, we find them like that today.
Thank you.
I think I'll have to close it there. Before we thank our speakers, I'll just remind you all that our next lecture is on Sunday, 16th October, 2 to 3, Rise of Empires. So if you're available, please pop by. Now, if you enjoyed me in thanking our two wonderful speakers...
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.